Welcome to What the Paper Said, in which I, Patrick Crozier, skim through the Times from 100 years ago, read some of the articles and comment on the ones I find interesting. In this episode, the week ending the 10th of December 1922, the UK loses one of its territories, for a morning and a bit of the afternoon. A judge warns of the danger of press barons. Evidence emerges that for once a quote about the First World War is true. Britain prepares for the next war, as does Germany. The Fitzroy affair drags on. Communists receive a lesson in etiquette. A financier receives a lesson in the correct use of client funds. And Americans get better at killing one another. Not in this episode, either for reasons of time or more likely reasons of my lack of understanding, is there's a big conference going on in Lausanne to determine the future of Turkey, which is likely to succeed. There's going to be another big conference about reparations. I'm not quite sure where it's happening. Brussels, I think, which is going to be less successful. There's the Ilford murder case. An Irish MP has been murdered by the IRA. And there's a continuing correspondence, a lively correspondence, in the pages of the Times about divorce law reform and how unemployment insurance should be organised, where it should be on an industry basis and all the problems to do with that. Anyway, Ireland is heading for an uneasy constitutional settlement. In 1920, the Government of Ireland Act was passed, splitting Ireland into North and South, each with its own devolved parliament. In 1921, the Anglo-Irish Treaty was agreed, creating a more or less independent Ireland with an opt-out for Ulster. The legislation to give force to that treaty has now been passed, and Ulster has a decision to make. This is from Friday, the 8th of December, 1922. About half an hour this afternoon sufficed to enable the Commons and the Senate of the Parliament of Northern Ireland successively to vote themselves and the people whose affairs they administer in the six counties out of the Irish Free State. Sir James Craig, he's the Northern Irish Prime Minister, declared that he will have nothing to do with the Boundary Commission. His government will ignore it altogether because the bargain about the boundary question was entered into behind the backs of the Northern government. Yes, I forgot to mention, there's a boundary commission to decide where the boundaries between Ulster and Ireland should be. And that's part of the treaty, not part of the Government of Ireland Act, so which means that the Ulstermen were excluded from that discussion. So that's what Sir James Craig is complaining about. He goes on. There is no use whatever in holding out any hopes of a desire on the part of the Ulster people to go in under a Southern Parliament. A position that exists to this day. It's worth pointing out that the whole idea of a devolved Ulster was not something that the unionists ever wanted. But it is interesting to note that Sir James Craig, now that he is Prime Minister, isn't quite so bothered anymore. Anyway, as far as the Boundary Commission goes, it would report a couple of years later. Its proposed adjustments were on the whole minor, but it did suggest that South Armagh should become part of the Free State, which, as the late David Trimble once put it, would have been good riddance. One group of people who no one would want to be rid of is journalists. This is from Monday the 4th. The Lord Chief Justice, Lord Hewitt, was the principal guest at the annual dinner of the London District of the Institute of Journalists at the Hotel Cecil on Saturday. The Lord Chief Justice replying... There was a toast. As it happens, that toast was given by J.K. Chesterton, but... Anyway, that's all he had to say. Anyway, the Lord Chief Justice replying said, "A newspaper has a considerable power, especially for mischief. Suppose that a man has acquired a great deal of money, and he puts that money into soap, mustard, tobacco, or any other household commodity. His opinions, likes and dislikes, are precisely of as much consequence to the civilised world as they were before. If he was a foolish person before, his friends know he is a foolish person still. But suppose that that same man chooses to put his money into double rotary printing machines. The merest caprice and whim of that man, by the mere force of this mechanical duplication, may become a danger to the peace of the world. Just wait, my lord, until you see what a blob can do." He goes on. "The merit or demerit of that which is given to the public depends absolutely upon the character and the attainments of the individual journalist. Well, in the vanishingly unlikely event that what you, the public, is given varies in the teensy-weensiest bit from the truth, you'll know why." One type of publication that regularly departs from the truth is the memoir. On Friday the 8th, the Times reviewed the memoirs of Crown Prince William of Germany. Now, obviously he's the Kaiser's eldest son, and he was given an army to command in the war. My assumption is, my belief is, that he had an experienced chief of staff to look after him. Anyway, he's published his memoirs. This is what it says. He did not relish, he says, Falkenhayn's language. Falkenhayn was the chief of staff of the whole German army at the time. Falkenhayn's language about bleeding the French army white. And when he realized that only a long-drawn slaughter was resulting from the enterprise, he became urgent, he declares, that the plan should be abandoned. We're talking here about the Battle of Verdun. Now, the interest to me is that phrase, bleeding the French army white. I first came across it in O-level history. That was my understanding, that I was given to understand that was the whole Falkenhayn's plan at Verdun. And that was the language he used. Since then, I've heard some doubt being expressed about whether that he ever uttered those words, although it would seem to be that that was always his intention. It's interesting here to me that this is only, 6 years after the events involved, that and in someone's memoirs, that phrase is being used. And it's being used, the Crown Prince is demonstrating that he doesn't like that particular view, which seems to indicate that Falkenhayn did actually say it, which is somewhat unusual for a First World War quote. Remarks like "Lions led by donkeys," "We sent men into that," and a few others were never said. The lamps are going out all over Europe. It's possible he said it, but Lord Grey as it was, but good chance he didn't. In 1921, Parliament passed the Safeguarding of Industries Act. This introduced tariffs on products regarded as vital in war, as well as anti-dumping duties in other industries. There was a debate about it in Parliament on Wednesday the 6th. This is how, actually it's Tuesday the 5th, I think. This is how the Times reported it on Wednesday the 6th. The whole case for the safeguarding of industries rests upon its necessity. If the national interest does not justify the act, it should at once be repealed. If, on the other hand, it can be shown conclusively that certain industries are essential to the state, their continuance must be safeguarded at any cost. The strength of the nation is of more importance than its wealth. On that there can be no compromise. Yet there are two aspects of the matter which, for the sake of clarity, should be discussed separately. The first relates to preparedness for war, the second to the efficient prosecution of industry. In both spheres, success is essential to the welfare of the nation. The outbreak of war revealed deplorable weakness in this country in the supply of munitions, particularly explosives, imperatively needed by the army and navy. In the next conflict, whenever it may come, victory will go to the nation that has been most successful in applying the discoveries of modern science to the arts of war. For that reason, not only must research work be undertaken, but plant must be provided capable of being rapidly adapted to the production of new and terrible munitions, the use of which will be decisive. That is the foundation on which the case for the safeguarding of the fine chemical industries, including dye-making, rests. I think the first point to make is that the Times is looking to a future war. The idea that the First World War, or Great War, actually I'm not sure even sure they call it the Great War, anyway, we'll call it the Great War, was the war to end war. Well, that might be believed by others, but it's not believed by the Times editorial staff. I think the second point to make is that they're not kidding when they talk about there being shortages. For instance, in 1914, the pages of the Times, or the small ads, were full of ads from junior officers saying, anyone got a set of binoculars out there, because I'm going out to France soon and could do with a pair. because there were none to be had. So yes, there were certainly many, many shortages. And was that better in the Second World War? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm not really an expert on the Second World War because it's merely a sequel. But I believe that it was one thing that was said in the Battle of Britain is that the RAF were never short of fighters. And they might be short of pilots, but never fighters. So it's a good chance they did do a lot better. I'm sort of amused by the remark about victory will go to the ones who are better at science. Is that true? It certainly was very close, I think, in terms of scientific endeavour. Although the Germans never got close to an atom bomb, so the Allies were ahead in that regard. Anyway, it would appear that the British are not the only ones thinking to the future. This is from Friday the 8th, and it's a letter from a Miss Charlotte Mansfield, who is a fellow of the Royal Geographic Society. Here we see the Germans appealing for assistance for German science. On the other hand, a number of German publishers refuse to sell their chemical books to non-Germans. To obtain such works, the bookseller must make a declaration that the intending customer is a German and is personally known to the seller, and the customer has to make a declaration in writing that the book is for his own exclusive use, that he will not sell or dispose of same to anyone, and will not allow the book to go out of Germany. Yes, I think that's pretty obvious what their intention is. And by the way, we should point out this is, of course, in the age before the photocopier. All very annoying. Talking of which, this is also from Friday. Mrs. Dorothy Turner, who gave evidence at the police court hearing of the charge against Sir Almeric Fitzroy of annoying persons in Hyde Park, was arrested yesterday in London on a charge of perjury. This is remarkable. Regular listeners will be aware of this whole case, in that Sir Almeric Fitzroy, who was clerk to the Privy Council, was wandering around Hyde Park, and he was arrested on a charge of annoying persons and interfering with persons and annoying them. And what happened was that it went to court. He's very good. A barrister destroyed the evidence of this woman here, Mrs. Turner, but it wasn't sufficient, and he was convicted and fined. It then went to appeal, and the conviction was quashed. And now, Mrs. Turner, who is probably a prostitute, that's certainly the implication of the appeal court, of the appeal hearing, is on trial for perjury. So, in terms of a reversal of fortune, this is quite something. And it certainly demonstrates the value of having a good lawyer. The police have had their hands full this week. This is from Wednesday the 6th. There was a disorderly demonstration by a few men of the communist persuasion in the central lobby of the Houses of Parliament yesterday evening. When the Speaker and members of the House of Commons, who had been summoned to the House of Lords to hear the Royal Assent to the Irish Constitution Bill, were passing through the central lobby, where visitors desiring to see members are allowed to wait, half a dozen men disregarded the call to remove their hats. A police officer swept their headgear off with his arm. Interesting that the police officer had the confidence to just remove these guys' headgear. I think if he did it today, he'd be on an assault charge. And now, competition time. Award yourself 1 point if any part of this story seems vaguely familiar. This is from Wednesday the 6th of December. The conviction of Gerard Lee Bevan, with a sentence to 7 years penal servitude, will be recognised generally as a stroke of justice. He occupied a responsible position in the City of London. He was chairman of the City Equitable Fire Insurance Company and was a partner in a long-established firm of stockbrokers. Great numbers of people, many of small means, placed their faith in him and his concerns. They have been ruined by his conduct. He has been found guilty of fraud in the issue of false balance sheets and of fraudulent conversion of property. Like others of his kind, he juggled with accounts. borrowing here to repay there, and weaving a skein of financial perplexities which eventually it became impossible to unravel. When the crisis came, he fled the country in disreputable circumstances, and he really confessed his guilt by seeking to enter a state from which extradition could not be obtained, and by adopting a disguise. See any similarities? Of course you didn't, because nowadays we have financial regulation. It is impossible for a violation to go undetected, as Bernie Madoff once said. And now, Stats Corner! This is from Friday the 8th. Statistics published today show that the number of murders in the United States is rising with appalling rapidity. In 1921, there were in the 28 largest cities 1,910 murders. Owing to various causes, this figure, according to Dr. Frederick Hoffman, the statistician of the Prudential Insurance Company of America, gives but an inadequate reflection of the homicidal mania, which is the greatest blot on the civilization of the country. Dr. Hoffman observes that the murder record of the past few years makes a glaring contrast to the predictions of those who in pre-prohibition times assured the world of the salutary effects of the suppression of the liquor traffic on the United States on the rate of homicidal frequency. It goes on. The rate in 1900 was 5.1, in 1920 8.5, and in 1921 9.3 per 100,000 of the population. The New York rate is only 6.2. For reference, the rate in 2020, which is the highest for quite a while, was 6.6. But the key thing to remember is that the prohibition of alcohol is in no way analogous with the prohibition of cocaine, opium, or any other mood-altering substance. Anyway, that's all for this week. I aim to have something up next week, but I promise nothing.